of Speaking, a monthly podcast on the spoken word. Episode number 77, June 2024. A unique path to film and TV success. A conversation with Lucas Hassel. Hello, Paul Meyer here. Last month, I announced my upcoming masterclasses. A few places are still available in the two July classes. But hurry, hurry, hurry. Each is on four successive Saturdays or Sundays in July 2024. It's Dialects of the British Isles, starting July 6th, and Coaching for Accent Modification, that's for coaches only, starting July 7th. For the details, visit the Zoom Masterclasses with Paul page on paulmeyer.com. That's under the Coaching tab on the website menu bar. A copy of my Accents and Dialects for Stage and Screen is free to each participant. I hope to see you in one or both of those two classes. I've limited space to just 8 participants, so you'll get lots of individual attention from me. Now, our old favourite, Guess That Accent. Last time I played this clip from the Idea Archive and challenged you to say where on the planet the speaker grew up.
My father and his brother and my brothers were musicians. They like to. My brother liked to play the trumpet. My father the drums. And my father loves to sing. Me too. I like to sing a lot. I don't know how to sing, but I love to sing. Music makes me very happy.
So, did you guess Mexico? If so, well done. It was Ideas Zacatecas 1. Zacatecas is one of the 31 states of Mexico. The capital city, also called Zacatecas, often called the Gem of Mexico, is more than 8,000 feet above sea level. For the full recording and all the documentation, go to Accents and Dialects on the menu tab of dialectsarchive.com, then North America, then Mexico, then Zacatecas. Like so many of our quiz subjects, this sample was recorded by our prolific senior editor, David Neville. Thanks again, David. Now, this month's challenge. Where did this speaker spend her formative years? You might get a clue when you hear her speak a little in the pidgin of her country.
My dear, today I'm driving taxi. It's not busy. I'm so tired. Trying to make money, stress out there, angry with it, but I'm all right. I come home, I'm happy. Ayo, today I'm Sunday, also later, so me go walk here. Yeah. I'm hard working. Me walk, you go now. Me not make money now. Me bella there. I wish me rich Mary now. Me not walk, Mr. Blouse.
So what's your guess? Get the answer next time. As you've heard me say before, if you aren't listening to me on paulmeyer.com, switch over now. Select In a Manner of Speaking from the Other Services menu tab, then click Episode 77. Lots of details about our guest and video clips of his movies. You won't find this stuff on any other podcast channel. My guest this month is Lucas Hassel, the celebrated Danish-American actor, director, writer. Also joining us is Cameron Meyer, film critic, Vice President of Paul Meyer Dialect Services, and Executive Editor of IDEA. And he's my son. Cameron's had the great pleasure of meeting Lucas in person, which, sadly, I have not.
Listen, we'll do this together, all right? We'll make a deal. I'm going to be with you until it's over, okay? Okay, buddy? Hey! Hey, buddy, are you there? Come on! We made a deal, remember? Huh?
I remember.
Okay.
Lucas Hassel in his short film Into the Dark. A native of Denmark, Lucas has carved a unique path to television and film success in the United States while doing it almost entirely in what is his second language. Welcome, Lucas.
Thank you for having me. Absolutely.
And welcome, Cameron. Thanks so much for suggesting Lucas as a guest. I know you've followed his work as a film critic. What's impressed you most about Lucas's work?
Well, first, it's great to be back on the podcast. Thanks for having me back.
You're welcome.
And let me also just say that Into the Dark is a great short film. Lucas, it's actually how you and I met about 10 years ago. That film was playing the Love Your Shorts Film Festival in Sanford, Florida, and I was covering that festival. I was fascinated not just by the film, but by your story. having grown up in Denmark and having success here in this country. So maybe that's where we should start. Lucas, do you want to maybe tell us a little bit about your early adulthood and some of your early fame in Denmark and sort of what got you into the business?
Sure, absolutely. As you correctly said, born and raised in Denmark, but always grew up in a sort of creative family. I think my father, in hindsight, wanted to be an actor, but back in those days, that just wasn't really accepted. So he went into his dad's company. And so I think my dad in particular was kind of tickled that I was interested in the arts. And so when I got the lead in a Danish high school play, The Scarlet Pimpernel, of all things, a well-known writer in Denmark was in the audience because her grandchild was in my year at school. And she came up to me afterwards and said, listen, I think you should consider taking acting seriously, and I can get you into some private lessons with one of the most well-known Danish actors around. And so before I knew it, steps had been taken on my behalf to sort of push me in that direction, because I didn't have sort of the guts to say no to that offer. And then cut to auditioning at Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland, where I got accepted and was offered a spot. And originally it was meant to be a sort of dress rehearsal for London, where I thought I was going. But when I got offered that spot, I didn't have the guts to turn that down. 6 weeks later, I moved to Ireland and went to Trinity College, worked in theater there. And a good 8 years later, I finally moved to New York in 96. I barely really acted in Denmark back then. I did a quick play after high school before going to Trinity in Dublin. And then I've been back a couple of times to do some TV shows over there, but haven't really worked in the Danish language very much. In fact, only twice. I did a Viking film last summer called Saga, which is about to come out. Other than that, it's all been in English.
Hmm. Now, Norwegians know you and still know you as Mr. Melk. That's a very famous advertising campaign for Norwegian milk, correct?
That is correct.
How did that come to be?
Tina Milk in Norway is one of the biggest corporations in Norway. Like, milk is a big deal, and it's all about getting milk from the cow to the table within 24 hours type thing. And so they take their milk very seriously. And the Tina Milk company were always known for their ad campaigns. And so somebody there got the idea to create this character called Mr. Milk, and they really had castings all over the world for it because they didn't want a Norwegian, you know, would be walking amongst them. They needed somebody else from abroad, and preferably with some kind of funny American Norwegian accent, whatever. And so they had castings mainly in London and New York. And through my then commercial agent, I got in there and was very late call. I think they did like one extra round of castings because they just hadn't really found whom they wanted. And I just remember at the very end of the casting, it was like weird casting because you had to do physical movements, which is always awkward on camera because you're acting with no one. So when it's very physical and you have a limited space, it's awkward. So at the very end of it, because it had been so silly, I made a silly face to the camera and sort of flexed my muscles and cracked some kind of stupid joke. And as it turned out, I found out that that was what got me the job. They were looking for an actor who didn't take himself too seriously and could have fun in the studio.
And I think we have a clip of Mr. Milk, don't we?
Here he comes. Hold on.
Hallo, alle sammen.
Hallo.
Da trenger vi bare litt norsk natur.
Ja, kjør på.
Det smart å leve sunt. Tina Milk naturlig rik på kjempebra protein som bidrar til å styrke og fornye musklene. Smaker godt.
I love that. That became a bit of a catchphrase in Norway. So smaker godt. So the campaign was a massive success, which was crazy. So all over the world, still to this day, if they're Norwegians of a certain generation, they will always come up to me and be blown away. That was a fun project over a good 3-4 years.
That's good. So that is your voice, of course, and speaking Norwegian, right?
So the trick was to learn Norwegian. I understand some Norwegian. I mean, the Scandinavian languages are connected, but I didn't really speak Norwegian. And so it was a challenge to learn it phonetically. But then as it turns out, they did want a sort of American accent spin on it anyway.
I'm fascinated by your polyglot nature, you know, many languages. So one of your big early successes, albeit a commercial, was already in a second language. I'm tempted to ask how different Danish is from Norwegian. And can you pass for native Norwegian? I mean, I know Danish and Norwegian are mutually comprehensible, though pronounced quite differently.
Well, I would say that they're, when they talk, they're not easily understood necessarily, but written Norwegian and Danish is very close. It's just the dialect comes in and it becomes almost incomprehensible to either one. I'd say it's kind of like Portuguese, Spanish, and Italian, right? So there is a connection between Swedish, Danish, and Norwegian, but there are also distinct differences. And so certain words will repeat, but the pronunciation is completely different and intonation is completely different. Danish is super flat. It's very, very short vowel sounds in the back of the throat, where I think both Norwegian and Swedish are much more sing-songy languages. I speak Swedish decently. So if I speak Swedish, it's more like, oh, we are here in New York, or jag pratar, jag baket med två vänner from Florida. So that's a sort of Swedish thing. Da, 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 da. But if I'm in Danish, it's like, jag sitter här på kameran och jag sitter och talar med två vänner från Florida I ögonblicket.
It is so impressive to us monoglots that you can move between four or five languages. I guess what, four or five languages you have?
I guess it's one of the both pros and cons of originally coming from a small nation like Denmark.
Yeah,
you can't expect anyone to speak your language. So from early on, we have French, we have German, we have, you know, I grew up with Swedish TV, was the only TV had when I was, what we had when I was a kid. Uh-huh. English, of course, was a thing. So my parents lived in Spain. So just by sort of being around things, I have a pretty good grasp of probably six or seven languages.
That's so impressive to us. I speak a little French. Cameron speaks a little French. That's about it. But I'm fascinated by your flawless American English. How did that come about, that you could absolutely pass for someone born in Cleveland or wherever?
So first of all, it's not flawless necessarily when I'm speaking like this. But if I get a script, I can definitely hone in on my weaknesses, right? Because I don't want to be self-conscious all the time about sort of correcting myself even before I utter the words. So as a person, I definitely can hear my Danish coming back on and off, but mostly it's pretty good. But if I have, as I said, a script, I can easily get rid of it.
Well, I've got my best ears on, and I'm not hearing anything.
Oh, well, I'll take it.
Nothing's giving you away, as far as I'm concerned.
I'll take it. Well, I will tell you, back in Trinity College, my acting teacher, who was head of the course, after I got offered the spot and I moved over, and sort of 4 weeks into classes, he pulled me aside and he said to me, just FYI, if you want to do anything but playing a table in your graduation show in 3 years' time, you got to have to work on your accent. And that freaked me out. So I started going to the language labs at Trinity College and listened to BBC tapes and sort of listened to my own voice back and just gradually really sort of focus on it, because I think, you know, it's a great thing to have the option of taking off your own accent, because I can always stick it on. This is how a Danish person would speak with a very flat accent in English, and so I can definitely put it on if I need it. But it's great to take it off if you don't need it, right? So the option is what you're after, and so I've always taken that very seriously. And so it's a lot about, it's just hard work and just being aware of the flaws that you keep popping back into, and then how can you elongate your vowels, because that's the challenge for a Dane, that their vowel sounds are very short, so you have to sort of always think of stretching and elongating the sounds.
You know, that in itself, Lucas, is quite impressive to me, because I've worked with many actors whose first language is not English, and who want to pass as American for American casting and so forth, or British casting. And sometimes they don't have the ability to put on the accent that they have worked so hard to lose. But you clearly would be castable as a Dane.
Absolutely. I mean, I was just visiting my mother in Spain, and her new husband told me that he couldn't hear any sort of American intonations in my Danish. He was very impressed with my Danish. And for some reason, that hasn't been an issue for me. I haven't been one of those that sort of lose touch, although I barely speak Danish day to day. But for some reason, that hasn't been an issue for me. I'm not sure why. I'm definitely fascinated by languages and stuff in general. And I write a lot as well. And so I have an excellent vocabulary in English. And I feel probably I express myself better in English than I do in written Danish, at least. I mean, I wouldn't even I haven't tried, and I don't think I would do well if I went back to writing in the Danish language, because it's just a lot of the little words are a little slippery for me.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you talked about how you mastered the American English. You've used dialect coaches, I expect, either for yourself or as actors you've directed, right?
I've been exposed to them when I've been on, particularly on TV. They are sticklers for details. And so I played a Dutch guy on a show called Elementary, and I had a Dutch voice coach for a week. And I've had dialect coaches on various projects, but I haven't necessarily hired one in my own time or used ones for people in my own projects. No, it's a tricky balance, because it's acting is so difficult to begin with. You're already struggling with subtext and figuring out who you are and all those character choices, and then when you put in something so technical as a dialect, it's very easy to get pulled away from the core of what you're trying to do and just start focusing on the dialect. And I think your performance can suffer that way. So I have always had a lot of admiration for actors who can seemingly effortlessly do both. So I wouldn't consider myself a great dialect actor, actually. There are other people that do that much, much better. There could be a cost of being so focused on a technicality that you lose the flow and the character, which is so important.
Exactly, exactly.
Lucas, I have a couple of other accent questions, but now might be a good time to play another clip, just so our listeners can hear your acting voice again and maybe compare how you're speaking to us now extemporaneously and a clip from one of your films. This is from Split Second, which is a great little short horror film that you did. How recently? This is quite recent, right?
This is like, I think we filmed it about a year and a half ago, and we're actually filming, it's being turned into a feature. So the short is going to be part of the feature. So we are still filming on that. I have some pickup shots coming up in the summer. So Split Second will be part of a feature called the Pitchfork Trilogy.
Great. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
Hey, what are you drawing?
Us.
That's awesome. But it's kind of late, honey. It's time for bed, yeah?
Can I please sleep with you and Mom?
Cammy, we talked about this. You're a big girl, and big girls sleep in their own beds. All right, let's go. Come on, let's go. And I got you this, remember? If you're afraid in the dark, you got the flashlight. And you got Lamy.
Can I please go to Grandma Helen's for the weekend?
I'll talk to Grandma about it, okay? Whoa. What happened here?
I don't know, but it hurts.
Well, it's just a bruise, but it'll get better if you don't touch it. All right, honey. Sleep tight, okay? Love you.
I love this one. This is so classy. It transcends the genre beautifully. I was gripped by it. It's an amazing piece. I'm not surprised that it got picked up as a full-length feature.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, I think it turned out really well. I'm very proud of this short, for sure.
What we just heard is a great setup for a very scary, smart horror payoff later in that short film. Right. And if you don't mind, I want to jump ahead just a little bit in our conversation, because this particular film also stars Dee Wallace and Austin Pendleton. Am I remembering the correct film, Lucas?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You've worked with quite a few very famous actors. You've also worked with Natasha Henstridge, I believe, on a couple of projects. Can you talk to us about any stories or words of advice or wisdom that you've gotten from some of the quite experienced actors that you've worked with?
Well, I mean, and since we mentioned Split Second, and since you mentioned Dee Wallace and Austin Pendleton, the clip you just showed, we shot that upstate somewhere, and that night a massive snowstorm came in, and so after wrapping, we were all meant to be driven back to New York, and we left set, which was a big house they have rented from this family, whatever. And we got about 10 minutes out and the driver was freaking out and decided to turn back. And so we went back to the set house, and the family there were kind enough to say, listen, stay with us. We have one big bedroom upstairs. So myself, Austin Pendleton, and Tara Westwood ended up sharing a massive king bed. So that was like my first threesome on set, so to speak. Nothing untoward happened. I will disclose that. But it was it was one of those moments when you sort of think to yourself, how did I end up here in bed with Austin and Tara, you know, upstate New York in a snowstorm? But anyway, so that's a little bit about that. But common for all these amazing actors. Dee Wallace, Austin Pendleton, Natasha Henstridge, Lynn Shea, I worked with many times. Common for all of them is when you come across real talent, there's just a sort of confidence that comes with that. They're confident enough to be present and to be kind with lesser known actors or lesser experienced actors. And so it puts everybody at ease if the bigger names are at ease with themselves, right? So the experiences I've had where the big name on the day or in the movie did not work out so well is usually based in insecurities. They lost their faith in their own abilities somewhere along the way, maybe because of typecasting or whatever it is. And so that's when you see sort of bad behavior and so forth. So when you come across someone like these who are just so solid in their craft, it's just delightful. And so if there's any wisdom or lesson to be had from that is that you just have to remember that be present and be pleasant, you know. And I direct films, that is literally the mantra I tell myself when I wake up every morning before going on set, because it's so easy to get, for me, it's easy to get micromanagerial and I know exactly what I want and I can be a little controlling. So you have to leave room for collaboration. And so be pleasant, be present is a mantra that I work with a lot.
I can't get out of my mind now Austin Pendleton from Muppet Movie and What's Up Doc and sharing a bed with this amazing actor.
I have photo evidence of it. We had a hilarious night. It was very funny.
Next time we hang out, Lucas, I want to see those photos.
Okay, will do. Will do.
Yeah. Jumping back up to the accent a little bit more, just to sum up that now that people have heard you in a couple of different clips. Do you have any advice for non-American actors trying to make it in the U.S. or reduce their foreign language sounds to pass as native-born American English characters?
It all depends on what your ambitions are, right? So if you have grand ambitions about making it onto bigger roles and big successful career, there is no doubt in my mind that you're going to have to work at your accent, right? If you come in, listen, there are exceptions, right? You have Selma Hayek, whatever. She never got rid of her accent. She's a very successful actress, but she'll always be that actress, right? You're going to cast her in some kind of Latina aspect, right? You're not going to pass her off as an American mom of whatever, whatever. And so that's just a choice that apparently I assume she made at some point, saying, listen, I'm happy with who I am, and that's my career. But if you come in with different aspirations to that, then it's just hard work. I mean, there's no way around it. Casting directors already they're quick to typecasting, for sure. If they see that you're from Germany and your name is Gunther, you're going to be seen for the SS officer 9 times out of 10, right? You're not going to be seen for John, the car salesman from Arizona. That's not going to happen. So you have to work hard at figuring out how to put casting directors at ease that you really are viable as an American, or so that you won't just be put in the corner of this and this. I mean, when I get castings for sort of big movies, it's usually the Scandinavian role, because the casting directors can then justify why I'm brought in for that casting. And that's why I generate towards independent cinema, where I don't have to worry about those boxes, right? I get straight to offers for independent film for people who have seen my work and don't have any qualms about putting me up for the lead in this show as an American dad or whatever it is. So for studio films, definitely, even I am probably typecast to a certain extent, and that's why I work more in indie. And then TV, they're a little more flexible in terms of dialects or accents. So definitely work on it. As I said, it just gives you more options. It's an option to take it on and put it off. And so why not give yourself that extra layer?
That's fantastic advice. I hope all my clients are listening to you. How do you balance your work? You seem to be equally divided, not divided, but inclusive of your writing, your producing, your acting, your directing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a tricky balance, mainly for my poor acting agents and managers, because of course I do travel a lot for my writing stuff. I have meetings out in LA and so forth, or I direct a film up in Seattle. And so all those times I'm away, I'm not doing castings for them, right? And we've had to find a careful balance of, you know, primarily I'm an actor, but I'm not the actor that sits at home and waits for that call. I'm just not that person. I think it's very important, particularly at my age maybe, that I am proactive. I'm just not that actor who wants to constantly give power away to others. And so that's why I got into writing originally. And that's how I got into filmmaking, is taking some of that power back, that as an actor, I give away all the time. I walk into a room, I do a casting, I hope I get cast, but it's really not in my control. You know, so I've had to have these conversations with my manager and agents, that it's, you know, everything I do is to support my career, is to further my career. And so hopefully in the long run, they're going to see that that will pay off. But it may mean that I'm not always around. And so I'm looking for quality castings as opposed to quantity castings. So I don't really need to go out, you know, five times a week for roles that I'm not interested in or that I'm not right for. So I'd rather just be in their books. And when that role comes in that I am right for, I'm grateful to be seen for that.
It's great to talk to someone who's taken such control of their career as you have. And you're in the driver's seat. It's amazing.
Are you probably best known for The Blacklist among mainstream American audiences? You did 13 episodes of that show. Stars James Spader. You play the character of Van Dyke. Is that correct?
Yes, that's fair to say. I mean, it's as an actor who really works in the independent film community mostly, getting a role on a mainstream network show like that is huge and very difficult to come by. And, you know, in hindsight, a lot of luck, as anyone would say, is involved in sort of getting a role like that. And so that's definitely the one that people know me for the best over here. And then, but in the indie world, I'm known for a lot of other films that the mainstream would never see necessarily. So it's definitely in sort of, in terms of the general public, this is the role I get recognized for.
We're going to play a clip from Blacklist season 8. Do you want to do a little setup on this?
So I'm sort of the right-hand man of the main villain for that particular season, Townsend. And in this case, I need to go in and warn my boss that FBI is up, there are problems ahead. And so I walk in to speak to him, and I'm sort of intercepted by the pharmaceutical help that my boss needs, this guy who sort of serves him pills all day long.
Let's listen.
I need to see him.
Hey, you work for a madman. This is insane.
Watch your words.
He's feeding off this, destroying himself and us. The FBI raided us. There are warrants for our arrest.
You're out of line.
To risk our own lives for some lunatic?
What did you call Mr. Townsend?
The man is avenging the death of his wife and children, which means we are the only family he has left. So we will take care of him the way he takes care of us. Now, let me do my work. And don't ever disparage the good man again.
I remember right after we shot that particular scene, I could hear the director on the other side of the set go, "Yes!" So that's always a feeling from the actor, because it's like most of the time you never even speak to the director on these TV sets. You sort of block it, and then you're sort of left to your own device a lot of the time, because directors on network TV sort of come in for an episode or two. And so they don't necessarily know what you've done in the previous episode. So a lot of them are hesitant to give you directions. It's really the producers and writers that have that power.
Sense of the continuity, right?
Yes, correct. Exactly.
You also have been in Elementary. You did an episode of that, Limitless. For people who don't know, Elementary is a contemporary version of Sherlock Holmes, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I think it's canceled now. Yeah, but that was with Lucy Liu and Aidan Quinn. Some really good people on that show. I did Blue Bloods, which... I did Law and Order. In fact, the very first job I ever did in New York when I just got here from Ireland was a small, tiny role in the original Law and Order with Jerry Orbach. And so that was a real honor to be on set there. And and Blue Bloods is, of course, great. And so, so I've been on a good few of the New York shows.
And this is what fascinates me about you, Lucas, is, so I'm going to go 180 degrees here.
Okay.
We're talking about these famous television shows, working with a lot of these famous stars, but how I know you is from the film festival circuit. And mm-hmm. I think when non-filmmakers and the general public hear film festival circuit, they're thinking Sundance or Toronto or Tribeca.
Mm-hmm.
But as wonderful as those festivals are, I know you from the small festival circuit, the Love Your Shorts Film Festival in Sanford, Florida, ARF in Austin, Texas.
Yep.
And you embrace those charming little festivals. That's where you've shown a lot of your work. Mm-hmm. And you seem to have this great balance between these two worlds. Talk to us a little bit about the film festival world that you're part of, because that's the world I'm part of too, not as a filmmaker, but as a journalist and a film critic. And I love that world. And I don't think we've ever had the chance to talk about the film festival circuit on this podcast before. So what is that world like for you?
So, you know, you and I, we met, as we just talked about at the beginning of this podcast, with Into the Dark. And that was really the first project that I put together as a writer, director, and actor. I shot it in my apartment and just had a ton of fun with that. And so you start with sort of any festivals that'll take your film, right? And in that case, Into the Dark did really well in the festival circuit. And as I tell other filmmakers, if you put in 20 submissions and you get into 15 of them, then keep submitting, because that means people are digging your film. If you submit to 30 fests and nobody takes them, then maybe your film isn't as together as you might have thought it was. So, you know, don't waste your money either. So I think getting into the film festival circuit with Into the Dark back in the day really showed me the importance of community and the importance of seeing what everyone else is doing and what other people are doing right and what other people are doing wrong, right? Because when I get feedback on my own scripts and my own work, you know, sometimes it's valid, sometimes I don't agree with it, sometimes whatever, but I can learn so much from watching others' work because I'm not as invested. It's not right in my face. It's not my own work. And I met a lot of people, and a lot of the work I've gotten in independent cinema, I can put a sort of red thread back to that film. It may not have given me a job the month after, but 2 years down the road, I would meet this director again, and they would come up with a suggestion of us collaborating, and it would come back to they saw my film back in some festival somewhere, right? Mm. So I'm very grateful to the film festival circuit, because it really is for people in the business. Because as you say, most people think of festivals of Sundance and Toronto and all that, which they're barely festivals at this point, in fairness, they're more markets. So real film festival where anyone sort of has a shot at getting accepted are these small to medium festivals out there across the country that have great support by the locals. They have a great old theater or cinema, and they're excited to have filmmakers come in from all over the world. And so that to me is just inspiring. I mean, as a person, I'm interested in people, right? That drives me as an artist. And so when you can go out and meet people that you wouldn't necessarily have come in contact with otherwise, and then share the work you've done with a full audience, that's a real gift. So when I did my second short film, I was still hungry for that festival circuit. And I did another huge round of submissions with The Son, The Father. Psychological horror did also well.
That's a great film, by the way.
Thank you so much. Very different to the other one. But after that, I will say I've just sort of taken a slight step back from the festival circuit in terms of, like, now I have made a lot of connections, and I do know a lot of people, and I've met a lot of programmers and fabulous artists out there. And so now I have a lot of friendships, and I do have a lot of people I can send my script to, I get feedback on this from, and so forth. So there's a slight thing of diminished return sort of to year 3 and 4 and 5 of these festivals. So it just depends really on what you're after, right? Because to a certain extent, I'm out there to remind myself of why I'm in this. So that's why I still like to go to some of the smaller festivals, to remind myself of why I'm in this. But it's also, you have to sort of figure out, well, it's no longer that helpful for networking. I'm not necessarily no longer going to meet somebody who might not know my work. So you sort of just adjust accordingly. And so I would say I'm less out on the film festival circuit than I used to be. But with the right film, you showed a clip from Split Second. if I feel strongly about a project, I would go out of my way to recommend it to a programmer or a festival that I've screened at already. And if they take it, I feel obliged to sort of come and support it since I recommended it.
I was struck by what you said about the sense of community and meeting people, because you and I would not have met if you hadn't done the festival circuit.
Exactly, exactly.
I know that you've met and started to collaborate with other people that we've met almost at the same time. I think Lisa Belcher is a common friend between us.
I did a short film with her called Guest of Honor that screened down in Sanford, Florida. And I brought Lisa down. I was so happy to show her this wonderful festival down there. And so she had a blast. And we just did a feature project together that I wrote. And she directed, and I'm acting it with Natasha Henstridge and Lynn Shea. And it's, again, it's a dark psychological sort of horror slash thriller called House of Abraham. And so that is just finished. And we are in negotiations with various distributors to, so we'll see where it ends up. But watch this space. It's hopefully going to be out sometime this year.
You seem to gravitate towards horror, suspense, sci-fi, especially the villain, or if not the villain, the sort of anti-hero. Do you find the anti-hero or villain more interesting? What roles are attractive to you as an actor?
Yeah, that's a good observation. Yes, as an actor, I definitely gravitate towards the darker roles. I mean, it's very easy for me to be cast as the nice dad, or, and all those roles are perfectly lovely, but a lot of the time they're not necessarily that layered or challenging. And I feel like when you get into sort of the villain roles, it's easier to put a spin on that for me. I just gravitate towards that. So even my headshot is sort of designed in a darker way by choice for me. When I went into the photographer's studio, I knew what I wanted. I knew what I wanted it to look like. I didn't want a sort of character picture, but I wanted it to have a darker feel to it, just because I feel like that's what I'm interested in. I also have a beard, I have long hair. So it's kind of like, I'm not going to be that computer nerd, or I'm not going to be that clean cut kind of character. I'm not going to be cast as that as long as I sport this look. And that's deliberate. I will say that. But, you know, in terms of my own writing and what I gravitate towards, I just gravitate towards layered material. And at the heart of everything I write is drama. But then you can gussy it up in sci-fi or gussy it up in horror. And knowing the business end of things more and more, the longer I've been in the industry, it's just any independent feature film, if it's not sci-fi or horror, it's just going to be a tough journey ahead, because nobody really acquires dramas, rom-coms. And so there is just an automatic built-in audience for horror and sci-fi. And of course, that also means that market is saturated with too many projects. So it becomes difficult in its own right to break out of that. But I just like the fact that you can sort of create your own set of rules in that genre. If you have something you really want to explore thematically, it's a little simpler in those genres, because you can sort of make up unnatural rules to sort of suit your intents and purposes. Yeah. You don't have to sort of stick to, you know, what people actually would do or would be exposed to. You can sort of add an incubus and, you know, mayhem ensues. So it's kind of like, it just gives you a little more freedom to guide what you're writing.
And yet, one of the most persuasive acting strategies, I think, for the villains and the malevolent characters is to sort of redeem them, is to sort of transcend the genre by playing that character as naturalistically and sympathetically as possible. And you think of, you know, Richard III, you know, being a charmer instead of announcing or telegraphing his evil intentions. How do you play with isn't it called playing against the text when you
yes absolutely. No, that's a very astute observation, and I had a very early lesson about that, because one of the first big shows I got in Ireland was Othello. And I was, as you know, now it probably would never happen in today's sort of world in casting, but back then in Ireland I was as exotic as they came. There were no African-American actors in Ireland, so I was offered the role of Othello. At a very young age, and I remember the actor we'll never hear this, thankfully, but I remember the actor being cast as Iago played it very mustache twirling, Iago. And I remember thinking in rehearsals, it wasn't for me to correct him. Obviously, that was the director's choice, never was. But I remember thinking, wow, he makes Othello look so dumb. Because he's playing it so large, Othello looks like he's thick. He doesn't see the villain walking around. So I remember thinking to myself back then, wow, if I was playing Iago, I would play him as nicely as I could, as, you know, no red flags of any kind, because that's when the evil then rises, right? Because people then are conned by that. And so in The House of Abraham that I just shot, I'm sort of the antagonist, really. Natasha Henstridge is the protagonist. And I'm essentially a cult leader who takes people in and offers to see their suicides through. And I'm as charming and as nice as can be. And of course, that becomes more and more eerie as the film develops.
Exactly. And of course, we all know that non-Americans, in the sort of limited view of American casting directors, are often chosen as the villain. The villain, you know, if you're foreign, you're the villain, right?
Right? That's fair.
And if you're well spoken, you're the villain, right?
Right, exactly. You see that consistently. And I sometimes wonder also if it's just American actors choose maybe not to be villains as much. And I think maybe European actors don't have a hang up about that necessarily. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. Chicken and the egg, who knows what the reason
is. Exactly.
Lucas, is there anything else that you would like to talk about or any other upcoming projects that you'd like to mention?
Well, you know, we mentioned House of Abraham, but I'm also, I've been shooting a project I'm very excited about where it's a docuseries about writers. It's called Madness and Writers, The Untold Truth, .. And it's, we've been traveling around pretty much for the last year and a half interviewing, season one is horror writers. We've been interviewing amazing writers. I spent 3 days with Chuck Palahniuk out in Oregon. He wrote Fight Club, and he's a big name in the sort of horror writing world. I met David Simpson, who is a writer who was a truck driver most of his life, and then on the road started to think about zombie novels and self-published a zombie novel that became a computer game and became a massive success. And so he is now a full-time zombie book writer. And you know, Josh Malamon, who wrote Bird Box, Netflix big hit. And so I've been traveling around with this as the host. And so I was hired because I'm a writer also. So I'm the host of this particular show. And so that's something we're wrapping up this summer as well. And then we'll see where it goes.
Lots to look forward to. Congratulations on your impressive career, Lucas. You've been very much in the driver's seat, and that's what I'm finding myself admiring more and more as we have spoken. Very independent, very self-actuating. Thanks for talking to Cameron and me today, and best wishes for those projects.
Well, thank you. Listen, it's a pleasure. Thank you for reaching out, and I'm always happy to speak to like-minded folks who are interested in this industry and the details of what that entails. So happy to be on again anytime in the future with other projects, but thank you so much.
Thank you, Lucas.
And thanks to you for joining me, Paul Meyer, my son, Cameron Meyer, and our guest, Lucas Hassel. Remember, for the extra material on Lucas and his work, go to paulmeyer.com, choose In a Manner of Speaking from the Other Services tab on the menu bar, and click Episode 77. Don't forget to follow Paul Meyer Dialect Services on Facebook and me on X or Twitter at @DialectPaul. Your comments and questions are always very welcome to paul@paulmeyer.com. The audio clips in this episode were all used by permission or taken from YouTube and used under the copyright doctrine of fair use. Details on the podcast webpage. Cameron joins me again next month, when our guest will be Audie award-winning audiobook narrator, actress, singer, and writer, Barry Krynick. She wrote and stars as the legendary Anglo-American actress Eva Le Gallienne in The Queen of 14th Street. It's an audio drama to be published in just a couple of days' time on June 4th, by Hachette Books. It's set in New York in 1932. We're going to talk about Le Gallienne's accent as part of a wider discussion of transatlantic sometimes called Mid-Atlantic, and old movie dialects. Barry's also a longtime idea editor. Next time on In a Manner of Speaking.